Come on, let's go. By shortwave broadcast, direct from important overseas capitals,
we are about to broadcast
this moment in our history.
Hello, and welcome to the History Workshop Podcast. I'm Mary Beth Hamilton. For the last few years, the writer Natasha Walter has been delving into her family's past as part of a journey propelled by grief. Late in 2017, her mother, Ruth Walter, took her own life at the age of 75. The shock of that loss, at first overwhelming, in time led Natasha to try to comprehend her mother's life on her own terms, to discover how her choice in facing her death aligned with her choices in leading her life. The daughter of German-Jewish refugees who escaped to Britain at the start of the Second World War, Ruth Walter committed her life to activism in the service of peace and social justice. In the early 1960s, she joined the anarchist wing of the British peace movement in the form of the Committee of 100 and Spies for Peace. And in the years that followed, she became part of the women's movement, devoting herself to working with refugee women, people with learning difficulties, and people experiencing mental health challenges. Outsiders, as she once put it, the people who had been the first to be gassed by Hitler. That story, and the story of Ruth's father's own struggle against fascism as part of the German resistance, forms the core of Natasha Walter's memoir, Before the Light Fades, a family story of resistance, an account of activism, solidarity, and the power of refusing to live in denial. Along with my History Workshop colleague, Andrew Whitehead, I sat down with Natasha Walter over Zoom to talk about her moving and illuminating memoir. And just a quick heads up, the conversation does touch on the fact that Ruth Walter chose to die by suicide, so please take whatever care you might need. I began by asking Natasha Walter how her journey to writing the book began.
I think after my mother's death, I found it very hard to meet other people's expectations of what I should be doing or what I should be saying about not only my grief, but also the manner of her death. You know, I think it's when somebody dies by their own hand, when somebody dies by suicide, people do have expectations around what that means and what that person's state of mind was. You know, I think there was this assumption very much that my mother's mental health must have been terrible, that she must have been in a state of despair. And I found that those kind of assumptions very, very difficult to deal with. And I found some of the expectations around how we deal with grief difficult. But what was important to me, you know, as a writer, as a person, as a daughter, so, you know, was to try and explore what my mother's death meant on her terms and on my terms. And also more and more importantly, as I moved on from the sort of immediate shock of her death, what I really wanted to do was I wanted to explore her life. You know, I wanted to explore not just that, the fact that she had chosen to die at that, you know, by her own hand, but why? And how had that led out of her life? Because I think for a long time I had very much underestimated my mother. Her death had come as a shock to me, and I realized that, you know, I think it happens to a lot of us, you know, with our parents, that we see them as they are when they're old, when they become more frail, when they become more tentative maybe in life. And I'd lost touch with Ruth as the whole person, you know, and so I did really want to explore her life.
And her life was remarkable. Her political activism, particularly in the 1960s, was, I mean, it's a riveting story. But she didn't keep a diary, and she didn't write a memoir. So how did you approach retrieving her life story?
I did find it challenging, I must admit, to piece together her story. But what I found when I was going through her papers, which of course took me a while, you know, I'm sure anyone who's listening to this who's been bereaved knows what that's like. It's hard to sort of dive in and start sorting through things. But when I started to look through her papers and her photographs and so on, I was really struck by, although there wasn't a huge amount of stuff that she'd left relating to her activities in the 60s, what was there was very precious and very important and really shone a light on some key aspects of her life and her journey into civil disobedience. So there was even the record, the papers from her very first arrest when she was aged just 19, and she went out into the nuclear disarmament movement, you know, on her own as a 19-year-old girl, which I think was unusual at that time. Also some, you know, great letters between her and other key members of the nuclear disarmament movement, of the Committee of 100, great photographs, minutes of meetings. And through those documents, through those photographs, through those kind of fragments of memory, I was able to trace her involvement in what I believe is a really, really interesting, important episode in Britain's radical history, and one that I think people often do forget and kind of gloss over.
And how much of this was familiar to you, and how much was a discovery?
I was definitely familiar with the sort of the bones of the story. And while my parents were alive, I had written, so when my mother was alive, this was after my father's death, I had written a couple of short pieces for The Guardian or The New Statesman about the Spies for Peace episode, about my father's imprisonment in 1967 on an anti-Vietnam War protest. So I had familiarity with the kind of the outline of the story, should we say. And what I did feel when I first settled down to start writing this book was, I just don't know enough about the sort of meat of it. I don't really know enough about my mum's motivations. I'm not a historian. You know, I felt very nervous about embarking on it. And more as I was working on it, I realized, you know, there were more memories that I could retrieve of what my parents had talked to me about, that they had been, you know, very open about what they'd done. Of course, my father, Nicholas Walter, had left some quite important and interesting writing about the time and about the historical context and the theoretical context, and some memoir writing as well. And also, wonderfully, my mother, when she was alive, had given two interviews to the oral historian Sam Carroll. And Sam very generously let me use, you know, refer and quote from those interviews. So it just shows, you know, I had access to many more different sources, I think, than I realized at first.
And the Sam Carroll's interviews, they informed her doctoral thesis, but also an article which appeared in History Workshop Journal.
Absolutely. I mean, she's done amazing work, I think, bringing this together. Also, of course, in my mother's papers, I found some of their correspondence, Ruth's and Sam's, and Sam's first draft of her article on Spies for Peace, and my mother's absolutely furious response about how she'd got everything wrong, and, you know, and how she needed to come and talk more about it and so on. So, I mean, Sam hadn't got anything wrong, you know, I'm exaggerating, but there was that sort of, you know, my mother felt protective, obviously, of the legacy. And that gave me confidence, actually, as well. I do want to say this, because I think there's often a feeling, you know, if you're writing about people's lives, people very close to you, loved ones, and you didn't suggest it to them when they were alive, but do you feel there's a trespassing? I think sometimes there is that feeling, particularly when I went into more personal aspects. It gave me confidence in writing the book at all, that it was clear that the legacy mattered so much to my mother, you know, that she'd given these interviews, she'd engaged with everybody who came to her saying, I want to, you know, I'm thinking of making a documentary about the Spies for Peace, or I'm thinking about, she engaged so generously, so wholeheartedly. She had no qualms about talking about her story. And so that gave me a lot of confidence.
I was really struck in the book with your description of part of what was impelling you was defining in those documents this person who was bold and courageous, and, you know, a contrast to the more sort of tentative person who she had become in her later years, and that it was part of honoring the person, the full person that she was. And
yes.
I, yeah, yeah.
This is absolutely it. I mean, I do feel that I underestimated my mother in her later years. I mean, the reason why she decided she wanted to take her own life is because she thought she had dementia. And there were signs of that. And she had become a more tentative person, a more nervous person in her own life. And certainly, as I came to look back at who she had been as a young woman, I was so struck by how bold she was, by how she really wanted to live life on her own terms. She wanted to go out into civil disobedience. She wanted to have an equal relationship. She wanted to build the sort of loving, free family life that she felt was right. So it was wonderful to me, for me to be able, I think, to honor that boldness, her youth, and her radical politics.
And her feminist consciousness, because I think for me, reading the book, I was so struck by the chapter. We're slightly jumping ahead in the chronology, but after the Spies for Peace episode, that the dissolution of your parents' marriage that comes alongside your mother's coming to into her own as an intellectual, as a thinker, as an activist. And your ambivalent feelings about that as a teenager and a young woman. I mean, just in terms of mother-daughter dynamics that I've experienced as a daughter, it felt very familiar. This sense of your mother, she's a different generation, she's a bit embarrassing, you want to be different than that. I thought it was extraordinary to read the kind of the nuance of the way that that plays out in your own feminism over time, looking back at your mother's life.
Yeah, thank you for that really, really thoughtful response. It's definitely a journey I've been on, and I feel I haven't yet come to the end of it, that it's something I'm still sort of reassessing and thinking about. Because certainly, my mother was in some ways the classic second wave feminist, although I think that she'd already come into that understanding of her own feminism before really reading some of those key feminist texts. I think they sort of, when she came to read the novel The Women's Room, I remember she liked very much, or Germaine Greer's Female Eunuch, I think they were reflecting back to her, understanding that she'd already come to herself through her involvement in radical politics and her friendships with political women, often slightly older than her, who had been very influential to her, I think, in the Committee of 100. She always talked very respectfully about women like Pat Arrowsmith, Helen Alagranza, and so on. And I think these female relationships were very important to her. So it was. She came into being a second wave feminist, literally at the time that second wave feminism was coming into being itself. And I do think that as a young woman, I absolutely reacted against what I saw as some of the personal aspects of that kind of feminism. So the rejection of conventional femininity, I found that rather uncomfortable, I think. We were growing up in a very sort of suburban environment. I was at a very conventional posh girls' school. And I think I didn't really see the necessity that my mother had seen of that kind of rebellion. And I think that's very much true of my generation as a whole, often, that during the 80s and the 90s, feminism did change quite a lot. And some of this sort of intransigence of second wave feminism was lost. And I think, looking back now, I think that was a real pity. And I think that there's, a power in that sort of intransigence, that, real rebellion against conventional femininity, conventional codes of consumption, of the domestic world that the woman is meant to uphold. I think it's a pity, in a way that feminism has lost that to an extent. And I've changed, and I wanted to write about how I changed as I grew up. And it was always something that Ruth and I spoke about. This wasn't something that was, that was off limits for us. We did speak about our different ideas about feminism.
You've talked about your mother's involvement in the Committee of 100 in the early 1960s, and you say that it's sort of fallen out of public memory. What was the Committee of 100?
The Committee of the Hundred was the more radical wing of the nuclear disarmament movement. When I try and explain it to audiences now who have no knowledge about that period of radical politics, I say they were the kind of the Extinction Rebellion to CND's Greenpeace. And I think there's a sort of, you know, a validity in that, although it doesn't, you know, the parallel isn't exact. But basically, the Committee of 100 was a group, a movement dedicated from the outset to civil disobedience. And from the outset, its members were prepared to risk arrest. It was called the Committee of 100 for the 100 well-known or reasonably well-known named figures that signed up at the outset. Some of them really famous. It was led by Bertrand Russell. And I think both my parents were drawn to it because it seemed to promise something new. Obviously, in its, you know, very intransigent resistance to nuclear weapons, but also I think the whole way of organizing that it built, the culture that sprang up in the Committee of 100, they found really, really attractive. You know, had that libertarian or anarchist spirit about the way that it was organized, non-hierarchical, very sort of open to new ideas. It was, I think, from what I can see from the discussions from the oral history that's been done by others as well, it was pretty intellectual. Members really enjoyed having arguments about political ideas and history, as well as how they were going to practically put that into action. And that was something that both my parents, I think, really enjoyed at that time. It was this sense that it was kind of the incubator of a new way of doing politics.
But it was also active on the streets, and your mother was arrested for the first time at the age of 19.
Yeah, so it was, the Committee of 100 was active on the streets from the beginning of 1961. And that was when my mother was first arrested on their first sort of major sit down. And it went on to organise further illegal demonstrations, a huge demonstration which had been banned in advance in Trafalgar Square in October of 61, where more than 1,000 people were arrested. And there was some evidence of police brutality, you know, protesters being dragged around, dunked in the fountains, thrown on the ground. And then they went on organising further illegal demonstrations and really met a huge backlash after about the first 6 months of organising, a huge backlash from the state, such that, you know, organisers were being imprisoned for over a year just for organising peaceful demonstrations. You know, demonstrators around air bases were met by armed police and dogs. It was a very, very aggressive response from the state. And that made it very difficult for the group to go on organising. There were so many arrests, so many imprisonments, and I think it began to feel, you know, as though there was a kind of shrinking space in which they could protest and organise. And I think we in Britain at the moment can really recognise that. I think there are real parallels with what's going on at the moment now in the environmental movement, where a group that started off with sort of high hopes of putting forward new ideas and trying out new tactics meets a much more aggressive response than was expected, and then finds it quite difficult to find ways forward.
But the fact that the Committee of 100 doesn't have a legacy in popular memory suggests that perhaps there are limits to how effective this form of action is.
I think what you're saying has some truth. I think it can be limited, this form of action, in that the Committee of 100 didn't achieve, you know, its headline aim to ban the bomb. But I think you also have to look beyond that and think about its effects more widely, culturally, certainly. I think it did have huge effects in terms of making people recognise just how many people, and a lot of them pretty mainstream, you know, whether you're talking about, you know, a well-known elderly philosopher, Bertrand Russell, or the sort of the vicars and the, you know, what looked like kind of conventional mums and dads that were joining in these protests. So people recognising that, you know, there is a more mainstream wellspring of resistance to what's going on in government. And that really, I think, did create a huge change in the 1960s. You know, when we look back at the 1960s, I think we're often encouraged to think about the changes that happened as more about people's personal lives, about, you know, sexual mores or, you know, what people were listening to in music or using drugs and so on. But there was also this huge political change, which was about laying aside that sort of deferential politics of the 1950s and being, you know, people actually questioning their government. And when you look at what a few of members of the Committee of 100 went on to do in the Spies for Peace action, when they broke into secret government bunkers in order to publish the plans for civil defence, which were then completely secret, I think that idea, that example, that you actually had to take a legal action and battle your government to get the truth out, I think that was very fertile and led to, you know, much more widespread understanding that the government doesn't necessarily have your best interests at heart, and that sometimes you do have to, you know, really battle the government to get the truth out.
And the Spies for Peace was a small and necessarily secretive group, and everybody involved in it was aware that they were in breach of the Official Secrets Act, and if they were convicted, they could face really quite a long time in jail. And yet your father was one of those who went secretly into the bunker, the regional seat of government, as it was called, outside Reading. Your mother was one of those who helped to publicise that by issuing basically a samizdat pamphlet. And you say in the book that to the end of her life, this was an episode that your mother was proud of, not only for what the Friends achieved, but for how they achieved it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think my mother, both my parents, I mean, I grew up with knowing about the Spies for Peace episode in its sort of basic outline. And I always picked up from my parents that they were, yeah, they were proud of it. I mean, they weren't, you know, they felt that it was a worthwhile thing to have done, and they were pleased by the way it panned out. So, I mean, as you say, they were running a big risk taking this action. It really actually gave me a jolt when I was listening back to my mum's interviews with Sam Carroll. And she said, I knew we were running a big risk, that there was the possibility of 20 years imprisonment if we were caught. I mean, I don't know if that's just her exaggeration, but it definitely, that gave me a big jolt, the idea of my mum at the age of 20, you know, her whole life ahead of her, thinking that she was going to take this action that might lead to a really long prison sentence. And even if it hadn't been that long, you know, it would have had a huge impact on their lives. But yes, as you say, you know, they went ahead. It was a brave and pretty well thought through action, I think, looking back at it. You know, it seemed pretty well planned. There was a small group that actually broke into the bunker, took photographs of what they found and copied details into notebooks and so on. And then they got together and put together a pamphlet. I think my dad's role was very much to edit that, because he was, you know, a great sub-editor. Very pedantic. So he was editing it, as you say. My mum was part of the group. She raised money for it, because she was sort of calling up people that she knew had donated to the Committee of 100, asking for money for the paper and the postage. And it is interesting. I know it's something that you've discussed previously on this podcast, but it is interesting to think about how people got secrets out in those days before the internet. You know, it did need a lot of organizing, people with practical skills, more people basically being involved. So you needed stronger bonds of solidarity and trust. And I think that's something that I found very striking looking at the history of those times, is, you know, what we've lost moving to digital campaigning. We've gained a lot, but I think those very strong bonds of solidarity and trust that people built up by working in that close-knit, face-to-face way, you know, that was very real and very important to my parents. And, you know, it was a group of friends that trusted each other to the ends of their lives. They didn't necessarily all remain close friends, but yeah, they trusted each other, you know.
And where did your mother's activism and sense of solidarity take her in the years that followed Spies for Peace? You've talked about the growth of her feminist consciousness, but it seems as though that she had a very expansive sense of her remit as an activist, I suppose.
Yes, I think that's right. She felt connected, you know, to instances of injustice whenever she saw them. I mean, there's some instances I don't go into in the book where things, you know, happened, say, in her workplace, that she wasn't happy. You know, she was always active in her unions. She went on to build a career working with people with learning disabilities and teaching English to new migrants and so on. She became then later as a social worker and working in care homes for elderly people. So she had a range of roles where she felt that she wanted to work with those who were marginalised by society, who had been let down by society. And in one piece of writing that I found in her papers, she said she'd always been drawn to work with those who would have been, out of context, maybe this sounds rather blunt and strange, but it's part of, I think, her Jewish heritage, those who would have been gassed by Hitler. So she's talking about people with learning difficulties there, as well as ethnic minorities. That was important to her, her Jewish heritage. And, you know, she was brought up the child of refugees who had come to Britain in 1939, making their separate journeys. Her parents married here in London. And although they didn't speak that much about their life in Germany as she was growing up, it was something that was very alive to her.
And you went back to Hamburg to find out more about your grandfather?
Yes. I mean, interestingly, as she was growing up, her father never spoke to her about his own involvement in radical politics, and in fact was absolutely dead set against her getting involved in anything that might bring her to the attention of the police, which she found absolutely baffling as a young woman and infuriating. And it was only later that she realised the extent of his own involvement in radical politics and the price that he had paid for that. And I think came to understand that more, because he grew up in Hamburg in a very poor background. He was trained as a lawyer. And he was involved in radical socialist and communist politics and didn't stop, you know, after the Nazis came to power, that involvement, and was imprisoned. He was imprisoned for 3 years. He was arrested, tortured by the Gestapo, held in a prison that then became a concentration camp. And he was released. So he was in prison from 1933 to 1936, and then basically went on the run through Europe. His journey went through the Netherlands and then to Prague. And when the Germans marched into Prague, he became a wanted man again and had to go into hiding, and then went over the border into Poland, and then was lucky to get the papers that allowed him to enter Britain in 1939. So really a sort of last minute dash out of Europe. And then when he got to London, sadly, my grandparents were then interned here in Britain as enemy aliens, as many German Jews were. And that also had a profound effect on him. So I think he felt that you just couldn't run the risk. He didn't want Ruth to run the risk of ever being in the position that he had been in and suffering as he did.
Did you get the sense, reading about this and knowing your mother, that she had had a similar kind of reevaluation of her parental legacy? I mean, the fact that he, circumstantially, it makes complete sense, this keep your head down, do not call attention to yourself, but that was, you know, in a way she went through a similar process that you did with her, of realizing that there was a backstory, and there was this person there who was much more complicated and much more committed to living an authentic life and dealing with the consequences of that.
Yes, I think that's exactly right. I think she did. I mean, you know, I think when we, because she and I went to Hamburg together once, I suppose when she was about the age that I am now, in her 50s. And I think she was very, very struck, very struck. I mean, I could see it, how moved she was emotionally by meeting someone that had known him well, you know, was a family member as a young man, and who had been involved in that communist activism with him, and talked about him as a totally different person to the one that she'd known. And I think, you know, that was very, very important to her. She felt that there was this very important legacy that she wanted us to remember, you know.
And how important is that generational legacy in your own activism and resistance?
I think my Jewish heritage has become increasingly important to me, or increasingly alive to me. I'm now much more confident since writing this book and delving more into the experiences of my Jewish grandparents and great-grandparents. I'm now more confident about saying that I'm Jewish, about being sort of visibly and publicly Jewish, and saying what that means to me. And I do think that at this time, when we often see the memory of the Holocaust being weaponized in further dehumanization or in closing down debate, it's become more and more important to me to try and stand up for what I feel is my family legacy, which is much more about, you know, justice for everyone.
I was really struck by the resonance of two words that are linked throughout the book. One was resistance and one was denial. Your mother refuses to live in denial, and you make a commitment to yourself as well. And I wondered if you could talk about that, because, you know, denial is one of those words that gets hurled around a lot. But to some extent, we live in denial all the time just to get through the day. It does seem very, very striking in your telling of your mother's life, that insistence on confronting things directly, which arguably is there at the end as well.
Yes, thank you for that. I do feel that denial kept coming up for me as I was writing this book in different contexts. And as I looked at, you know, how I had tried to deny what my mother had been saying to me about her own understanding that she had dementia, and about her feelings that she wanted to end her own life on her own terms, when I looked at, you know, her very strong belief that it's really important not to live in denial, that you have to face up to even unpalatable truths. And that was the reason that had led her into the nuclear disarmament movement in the first place, because she felt that people were simply denying the possibility of this apocalyptic nuclear war that she felt was, you know, and clearly was a possibility at the time. And then I do find echoes of that as well in looking at my grandfather's life and his decision. You know, when he was a young man, he really wanted to square up to what he thought was happening in Germany. And he did that by getting involved in radical politics. But in doing all of that, in looking at those different ways in which denial plays out, what I'm not trying to do is to say that there are direct parallels. I do think that, you know, people living in 1930s Germany were just living in very, very different times. And I think, so it's not a direct parallel, but I just wanted to look at the way that this plays out at different times. And then I do find that connecting very much to my own kind of political reawakening, which happens during the book, you know, as I am dealing with the grief that I'm feeling about my mother's death. I'm also dealing with a sense of political grief. I'm finding it very hard to be active. I'm feeling sort of politically disengaged, kind of hopeless a lot of the time. And as I sort of work through what my mother's response was in dark times, what my grandfather's response was in dark times, and their courage in facing up to what was going on, and their courage in standing up and doing what they believed was right, I do find more courage myself. And again, I'm really not trying to say, you know, that I'm courageous in the way that my mum was or the way that my grandfather was, but it just this parallel about, yeah, how do we stay hopeful in dark times? And right now, I think as we look at what's happening, you know, with the climate emergency, with this rise of populism and far-right politics, which is so hard to break through, with this kind of hopelessness about how do you build a political alternative in these times, I think, you know, it is really hard to keep that kind of hope alive. And I do, what I find towards the end of the book, that it, what works for me is stepping back into activism again, becoming more active again, becoming engaged in civil disobedience myself. I'm involved with Extinction Rebellion, but also, you know, just doing the work that we do in our neighborhoods, our communities. I work with refugee women, and kind of reconnecting with the things that are worthwhile, that we believe in. And, you know, what I say is, by acting as if there's hope, I do find hope stirring again. And that is very important for me. I think people often say, how do you keep hope alive in these dark times? You know, I don't, it's hard, but sometimes you just have to act in the faith, even if you don't have the hope that better times are possible.
Many thanks to Natasha Walter for taking part in this conversation and to Andrew Whitehead for making it happen. You can learn more about them and their work on the episode page for this podcast. You can also learn more about the Spies for Peace, the Committee of 100, and the British Peace Movement on our interviews with Jay Ginn and Nick Rolfe in earlier episodes of this podcast. Please visit our website, historyworkshop.org.uk. You can find us on X at HistoryWO and on Facebook and Instagram as History Workshop. This is the History Workshop podcast. I'm Mary Beth Hamilton. Thanks for listening.